We've just come through almost a few months now, I think, of looking at the first two limbs of the Buddha's Eightfold Path. We spent a number of weeks looking at wise view, a number of weeks looking at wise intention, or right view and right intention. Those two limbs, view and intention, are the section of the path oriented toward wisdom, or punya. And the limbs now turn toward what's known as sila, or action. And the next three limbs are right speech, right action, and right livelihood. And together they comprise the ethics, as it were, section of the path. Very often when the path is described, the ethics or action sections come first, and the path is often summarized as sila, samadhi, panya, where sila or ethics is the foundation, samadhi, cultivation of the mind and heart, is the development that's based on that foundation, and then panya or wisdom, it's the Pali version of the Sanskrit word prajna, the same wisdom as in prajna paramita, the perfection of wisdom, where wisdom is the culmination. But in the list of the Eightfold Path, the wisdom limbs come first, partly because, as we discussed from a bunch of different angles, wise view has to be present before the path can unfold. You have to know, in a sense, what you're doing or why you're doing it before you know what to cultivate, what qualities to bring in. So one way, as over the years, I would think about the Eightfold Path, and I would say, like, it's true that all of the limbs we practice in a non-linear way. Like, we're practicing meditation even as we're working on ethics. We're practicing seeing clearly with wisdom even as we're working on meditation. They're all aspects that you know, are laid out as if on a wheel and are simply aspects of practice. That's true. But it's also true that they are arranged in sequence. And as we start the action limbs, I want to say a little bit about one idea for why they're in the sequence that they are. And this proposes that in a way, particularly the relationship between the view and intention limbs and the action limbs have a certain direction to them. And I'm going to say that direction is outward. So here's the idea. Beginning with right view, the first limb, this is, in a sense, the innermost orientation of the heart. How do I understand the world? And this is, in a way, the first step in the path when, upon hearing the Dharma or the teachings of wisdom, I'm invited to shift the way that I think about and orient to my life. So this is like a seed. And it's not an action yet. What right view isn't an action. It's how I understand what's happening. But based in that understanding, this intention begins to arise. Right? If I see the world through right view, part of how I see it is I see what causes suffering and what doesn't. That's one of the core aspects of right view. What helps and what hurts? What leads toward liberation? What leads toward more confusion and pain and hurt. As wise view matures, it starts to turn into this beautiful discernment where, in a sense, moment to moment, all I want to know is, given the choices available to me in this moment, what's going to help the most, the situation? Yeah, I even start to drop the kind of selfish habit of separating myself from others and you know, the way it can feel like, what's going to help me? And you know, I can't even deal with others right now. They're so confusing and it's complicated and I feel like everything is scarce. You know, what's going to help me? That starts to settle and it just starts to become, what will help this general situation? Let's say we were all in, you know, a bit of a pickle. And I had matured in wise view enough to not be caught in a fixated sense of self. or caught in a kind of deluded denial about the situation, I would be able to see clearly the pickle that we're in. Oh, look, this is what's happening. And here's who's here. And very naturally, the impulse would come, how can I help? How can I help the general situation as best possible? And so from wise view, an orientation toward doing what will be most helpful arises intention. So intention is kind of a seed of action, yeah? And the intentions that we've been talking about, the intention toward letting go or renunciation, the intention toward non-ill will or letting go of hatred from our hearts, healing hatred and bias and ancient trauma from our hearts, and then the intention toward non-violence or letting go of the habitual or reactivity that leads to actions that cause harm. If those are the core intentions, you can see that where this seed of intention planted in right view starts to grow, it starts to grow into action, right? Intention is like, what am I going to do? So from the most internal view, intention starts to open out into action, says, what can I do in this world that will be helpful? And then the three limbs of action that we're beginning to open into this evening, the first is speech, right? Speech. So the first of the actions is speech, how I talk to myself and others, of course. This interesting way that words are so powerful, they do create relationship, they create everything in a certain way. And in a subtle way, they're physical, but they're not yet fully physical. There really is this distinction, and this is in many, many of the mystical traditions, a distinction between speech as a kind of energy and physical action as a kind of energy. You know? And so the limb of speech comes first as a kind of beginning of intention. And you could think of it even as speech like a magic spell, that the intention arises, oh, I'm going to let go, heal from hatred, and try to protect life rather than harming life. And this first might show up even as a thought. Right? Right intention is also translated as right thought. Right? How do I think about my life in the world? That's speech. So the very beginning of telling myself, oh, I'm going to do this or do that, that's speech. Yeah? And it's right speech when it's oriented toward well-being, coming through right view and intention. And then verbalized speech, right? Bigger speech. We send some air through the vocal cords and we use this language that we share to whatever extent we do. And then we say things. And those things, of course, are kind or unkind, helpful or not helpful, timely or not timely, harsh or gentle, useful or not useful. All of those dyads, of course, are spectra. And it gets complicated very quickly, right? You can say something that's true but not useful, or, you know, useful but not at the right time, or, you know, or not true but useful. Yeah, right? All of these have their cases, right? We could go through sort of case studies of these. And speech becomes one of the first places, for many of us, one of the most powerful places of practice, because it's kind of the first place where the internal intention toward goodness really, you know, like the rubber hits the road as soon as you open your mouth. It's very good. It's very relatively easy to connect with your sincere intention toward love and kindness for everybody. May everybody be well, you know. I just came from retreat up at Spirit Rock. It's so peaceful. Right? The food is good, the rooms are good, the people are nice, the teachers, it's all sort of very nice. And everyone's doing metta, like so much loving kindness. It's the place is like saturated with the wish that all beings are well. It's really like you practically like don't even have to try, you know, to be kind. Soaked into everything that happens there. And at the end of retreat, we say, okay, silence is broken. Like, talk to each other. And people, you know, come out into the dining hall and they're like, hey, and they're like, hey, and they're like, ah, people talking. It's intense, you know. I never liked that part. I was like, hey, more silence, please. One year, I'd been assisting or something. There was a long retreat, and maybe I was on it, but I had come out a little early. I'm not sure. I wasn't completely in my retreatant role, but I had two friends there who had been fellow yogis on the retreat, and one of them was totally a retreat junkie. She had done the 3-month retreat at IMS, and then she had just sort of holed up at a Dharma center for a month, and then come back to do the 2-month at Spirit Rock, and then she was kind of just like spinning her wheels a little bit and trying to plan and figure out how to get to Maui for the summertime, and then back to IMS and back to Burma, and it's like, and so the whole 2-month retreat, you know, and she hid out in her room for the whole sort of breaking silence talking period. And on the closing day, the retreat is closed down, everybody's chattering up a storm, everyone's happy, there's lots of hugging, all that stuff. And I'm down by the gate, and I see the two of them in their car, and they're just like slowly driving out. And I'm like, oh, hey, you're leaving, I didn't see you were leaving. And they were like, and I was like, what? And my friend said, we're leaving early because we want to stay in silence. And I was like, where are you going? And she's like, we don't know. Maybe to the beach? I'm not sure. But I don't want to start talking yet. And you know, really, no problem. Like, carry on. Like, you know, sure. But I really understood the feeling, right? Because in a sense, being sheltered in the bubble of silence, it's everything is easier, right? Because the hardest thing is people. You know, Sartre got it right. You know. Right? From No Exit, hell is other people. That was the thing. He only got it half right. Totally a footnote about the existentialists. Very nice. Philosophically, they were totally right on, but they didn't have a practice. So like they got it about what exists and what doesn't exist, all that. But they didn't have a practice, and so then they were miserable. I say they broadly, they were all different, but. And I love them. That was my philosophical tradition, really. But I always wanted those guys to be happier. You know, I'm like, that's true, you know. But it's not so bad. Heaven is also other people, it turns out. But people is where it gets challenging. So here's the pathway from view. Opening the mind toward the Dhamma, toward liberation, intention arises toward goodness, essentially, to cultivate goodness. And the first place it manifests is in speech. Then it opens out further. Speech becomes action, and action is, you know, the classical relational actions with the precepts. And the limb of wise action technically is the first three precepts, not taking life, not taking that which isn't offered, and not misusing sexuality. Partly because the fourth precept of wise speech is already has its whole own limb, and we may talk about a little bit in this sequence about the fifth precept. Of course, we'll talk about the fifth precept of intoxicants because it's so interesting. But in a very interesting way, it's not always the fifth precept in the lists. Sometimes it's omitted. It's the one that kind of comes in and out in different ways, and is expressed in different ways. So we'll chat about that at some point. I'll put out some promo. We're going to talk about the fifth precept and fill the room. Everyone wants to know. Can I get high? You know, that's like it's the only question, right? Is it okay? So the limb of action is the first three precepts. And these are the ones that are really concretely, you know, physical actions that affect others, how we deal with our bodies, with our property, and with our sexuality, these kind of big areas of communal life. So view, intention, speech, action, right? Bigger and bigger. Action, but the action that the precepts talk about is still largely like one-on-one or small community-based, you know? Yeah. Let's see what to do here. I should plug that thing in, shouldn't I? I'll talk while I do this. So, the action of the precepts is still smallish, you know, not harming people, not harming, not taking that which isn't offered. And so then the limb of livelihood, I think of, so livelihood, how you earn your money, you know, it says like, don't be a butcher, don't kill for your livelihood, don't sell poisons, that kind of thing. That's the classical list. We'll read it eventually. The way I think about the limb of livelihood, and that we'll talk about it, is basically that's the further opening outward of the wise action limbs, where livelihood really means how do you interact with the larger economy? And that's where we'll start to talk about like how our actions, you know, affect the whole world, how we move money around affects the whole world. Okay, pause, let me figure out how to plug this thing in. That's close. Yeah. You just want to get out of the frame, don't you?
Yeah.
So, let me stick it over here. Cool. You there? Hi. All right. I know young people interact with these things much more smoothly, but you know, I'm not used to it yet. So I want to talk tonight as we just begin this series with this sense of here's how the path goes from inward orientation out. Speech contacts others a little bit. Action contacts others even more. Livelihood, I'll propose, contacts the whole system in this full way. And then flashing forward, it'll take us a little while to get there, but what then happens with the meditation limbs, right? And I wondered about this, like, what is that? You know, because then it's effort, mindfulness, and concentration. And where effort is this very, like, you go internal with the what's helpful and not helpful. You start to work with your states. And then mindfulness really, you know, using that as a basis, analyzing things very, very closely, observing impermanence, observing the fluctuating experience, really becoming steady. And then concentration itself, the full stabilization of attention for precise, clear analysis of things. And in a way, I'm not sure which of these models I prefer. The way that I mostly think about it is we go all the way outward with livelihood. In a sense, you tend the ethics of your action until you've taken in the effects of your actions in every level that you can contact. Right? I've investigated how my actions impact myself, my immediate family and community and relationships, and all the way out to the whole world through economics and the way our communities are interwoven. And having done that, I am ready in a certain way to turn inward. It's almost like until I tend the full impact of my actions, I can't completely go to the internal parts of the path. And the sense that we get in some of the texts is that the purpose of the ethics limb is that your heart or your heart mind starts to feel blameless eventually after you've been practicing in this way. In other words, how can we bring our hearts to a state where we really could turn inward and then let go completely, right? Now, this is really the part where we turn toward, like, what is liberation really? How full is that letting go? What do I have to let go of? The limbs on ethics say to us that if there's a kind of harm being caused by our actions and we're not aware of it, we haven't brought it into the field of our practice, that will be a hindrance to liberation. Because in a way, the very classical answer would be karma is still being created, that's gonna limit how I am able to let go. And so I think of speech, action, and livelihood as like, you know, clean the whole house top to bottom, or really, really be awake to everything about how I interact with the world as best I can. Because once I have a clear sense of that, then I know what I can let go of. I know how to let go of actions that cause harm. And then more and more, the heart has fewer and fewer regrets about its actions. And it's able to let go and to settle. So then effort, mindfulness, and concentration turn back inward. Right? And they settle further and further inward until, you know, like when you used to turn the television off and it would go down to one bright spot and then gone. Right, grasping simply releases. That's one idea. I sort of like that. It gets big and then it gets small again. It could go the other way. You could say like, oh, you know, wise effort for states, you just get bigger, and mindfulness, you take in infinite subtlety, and in concentration, the mind is as vast as the universe. It also feels like that sometimes. And so that might be a kind of one-directional thing, but I prefer the full cycle version, where there's a sense of expansion and then a sense of drawing back in. So I want to read you just a couple little texts to open the conversation on the ethics part of the path. And the first one, I posted these on the webpage where I'll collect these talks. So you can look these up. But to start the series, here's a poem from the Theragata, which is the verses of the elder monastics. So these are all poems, you know, said to be written by or at least associated with like senior monks and nuns. There's a collection from the monks and a collection from the nuns. They're gorgeous, both of them. So this one is the poem of a monk whose name was Silawa. And so sila is the word for virtue or ethics or morality. So he's a monk named the ethical one, the one with ethics. And I have a special spot in my heart for that because that was my monastic name when I was in Burma, Sila Rakita, protected by ethics. And the protected by is really important. That's actually one of the most important aspects of the ethics conversation in Buddhist life, is that it protects you, right, from yourself, of course. You know, that in a way, unethical action or misconduct is, besides the harm that it does to everyone else, as it does, it is one of the most destructive things that you can do for your own spiritual path, right? If I cause harm, especially knowingly, you know, with intention, causing harm, doing something that's breaking the precepts, that's a kind of, in a very classical way, that's a heavy karma to carry, and I will have to carry it until it's resolved. So whatever has been done, whatever I've done that broke a precept will have to be met, processed, resolved in some way. And the idea being that, like, if you're doing that, it's impossible to get further awakened. It's impossible to be fully liberated if there's unresolved karma. And so that doesn't mean you have to consciously go in and, like, you know, attain forgiveness from every single person that you cut in line in front of at the grocery store, taking what wasn't offered. But as you grow in practice, you may grow into the kind of person who, even if you're in a rush, just wouldn't do that, right? When I was a teenager, I stole a lot of things, minor things, but one of the things I stole was a little collection of multi-sided Dungeons & Dragons dice from one of my friends. I just didn't want to go buy them. My parents weren't taking me to the store to buy multi-sided colored dice. So I stole them from my friend, but I kept playing with him, and he was like, that's my dice. And I was like, no, 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 I bought these. I lied, so I stole and lied. And the way that, like, you know, I was like 14 or something. And you might think of, you know, things like that you have as well. You know, everyone, whatever, and in a certain way, it's great to even think of things that are relatively minor. You know, I don't know how minor this was to him. He was really upset, actually. I'm sorry about doing it. I never got to apologize. Our friendship, as one might imagine, ended quickly, and I haven't seen him since that moment. But I feel it, and any time I tune into it, I can feel it. Yeah, and so to the extent that what do I remember from being 14? I remember the 10 things I did wrong and not much else. Because that's how misconduct and trauma, which is to say other people's misconduct, right, sticks in the system. It sticks far deeper in a certain way than the pleasurable things. The pleasurable things created the general base of well-being that I mostly operate from. You know, I was a privileged California suburban kid, more or less loved and cared for in a kind of freezy suburban sort of way, but without overt abuse. So that was the generalized backdrop. But what do I really feel when I contact it? I feel these moments of sting, you know. And so that's really what it means by, like, oh, if you learn to stop doing that, whatever it is, these moments of misconduct, what you're doing is you're setting your, besides creating safety for the people around you, which is tremendously important, you're setting up your future life and your future lives for well-being in a way that it is no small thing. It's no small thing. Once you have maintained a kind of clarity of action for some years, you feel it, you know? And you might notice, you might think about something that you know causes a lot of trouble in the world, like whatever it is, you know, really like striking somebody physically or cheating on a relationship, you know, or you know, lying or stealing or kind of one of just categorical, archetypal, harmful actions. And you might notice if you have not done those things, or if you haven't done them in a long time, right? And notice how that feels, that you could tune into a kind of absence of trouble in your heart around this thing. And that's considered a very, very precious belonging, something to cherish and something to protect. Protect the feeling of having not caused harm. Because based in that feeling, then the meditative limbs can happen, right? Then the mind can simply settle. The mind that is not holding on to regret and worry can settle in meditation. So here's the poem from the elder Silawa, the Buddha's disciple, devoted to the practice of ethics. One should train just in ethical conduct. For in this world, when ethical conduct is cultivated and well-trained, it provides all success. Desiring three kinds of happiness, praise, prosperity, and to delight in heaven after passing away, the wise would take care of their ethics. So, three kinds of happiness. Praise, very nice. Prosperity, very nice. And heaven after you die, very nice. Always the footnote, remember that Buddhist heaven and Christian heaven are different. In Buddhist heaven, it's a very, very, very lovely, super awesome, nice place that you can get reborn in after you die. And you do that based on your good actions. So in that sense, it's sort of a parallel, except that it's not permanent. It's another lifetime. It's a divine, lovely lifetime as a divine being. If you're very generous and ethical, and et cetera, but not liberated, you can get reborn in the heaven realm. It's a way of saying, you know, that good action leads to pleasure and ease for a long time, right? You don't have to think about it metaphysically. You could just think, like, think about people who are basically good people and are basically happy people, and that there's some way that conditions have conspired to make that possible. You know? And if they were unethical or harmful, it wouldn't be that way. They wouldn't be as happy. It wouldn't be as stable. But so heaven after you die is a classical, very traditional way, a thing to want. So three kinds of happiness. Ethics gives rise to all of those, praise, prosperity, and heaven. Silawa goes on, the well-behaved have many friends because of their self-restraint, but one lacking ethics of bad conduct drives away their friends. It's true, I tell you. A person whose ethics are bad has ill repute and infamy. A person whose conduct is ethical always has a good reputation, fame, and praise. Now, of course, you might say, like, of course, that's not always true, right? There are people with good ethics who don't get praised because, you know, because other people don't have good ethics, you know. But you might think about this in the large sense, almost like in the lifetime sense. You know, we could think of historical people who, let's say, didn't get a lot of praise or prosperity, but were really ethical, were really like moral, upright people. And part of what happens after they die is that their reputation is clear. There's a kind of like, this was a good person, you know? And we could think of often in, you know, there are some religious figures that are like this, there are some activist figures that are like this, who were just good. And you're like, oh, that was a good person. And of course, out of the public eye, just in ordinary communities, there's so many people like this that are just good people. And they may not have been wealthy, they may not have gotten a lot of overt praise, you know, but people in the community would know, like, oh, that person, they're a good person. You can trust them, you can go to them when things are rough, you know. And that's a powerful thing. So here's then a bit about the practice. Ethical conduct is the starting point and foundation, the mother at the head of all good things. That's why you should purify your ethics. Ethics provide a boundary and a restraint, an enjoyment for the mind, the ford where all the Buddhas cross over. That's why you should purify your ethics. This is three beautiful aspects of ethical practice. A boundary and restraint. This is kind of the classic, when I think about, you know, taking something that isn't offered to me, and it occurs to me that I've taken the precepts and I know what the result of doing that is, and I just don't do that, you know. When I'm at your house as my friends and I see your beautiful collection of colored dice, I won't take them, right? You know? And so that's a boundary, that's a restraint. And there's a way that ethics, you know, in its very basic sense, and we'll talk about this more as we go on, of course we wish that our culture knew much more about this, but they provide a boundary that gives protection, that offers safety, right? If your friends, the people around you, if they know what your boundaries are and that you're not going to cross them, you become one who is trustworthy, right? And that's a pleasure for you and a pleasure for them. And so then it goes on. Ethics are a boundary and a restraint. They are an enjoyment for the mind. And I like that it makes that jump. They're not just like, stop yourself from following your evil desires, right? Your desires are not evil. They're organic and natural, but they are also ancient habits that do well to be challenged sometimes. But I love this line, that it is an enjoyment for the mind. So here's a first little practice with the ethics thing. Out in your life somewhere this week, whatever you're doing, see if you can notice a moment when you make a choice, and the choice is between something that is, you know, somewhat less ethical and somewhat more ethical. And it might be very, very minor. I'm not even sure what it is, you know, that is more or, you know, or less ethical, you know. Who knows? We were talking this week about, you know, whether it's ethical that we use our niece Abby's Netflix account to watch the three television shows we watch a year, you know. And we have, and you know, as a family devoted to our priesthood, we actually had the conversation. We were like, yeah, we are taking what isn't offered, but Netflix is this sort of massive, weird, evil corporation, and we are family, sort of family, but they would actually rather we had a family plan. But, you know, and so we were sort of talking about, like, and of course, as a long, you know, as those of you who know me, as a sort of grumpy, sarcastic, anti-capitalist, I'm a little bit like, you know, observe your precepts and stick it to the man. You know, kind of do a little bit of both of those. And so the point is not like, you know, be impeccable. The point is be impeccable. But but more deeply, the point is that it's not obvious what that is in every situation, you know. And what really matters is not actually like what exactly you do in those, in let's say a sort of borderline situation, but the fact that the fact that the heart grapples with it is the most important thing. So the thing that the precepts are is they're a smoke detector, right? You take the precepts, right? You're like, I'm not gonna kill beings, I'm not gonna take stuff, et cetera, et cetera. And then it's not that, like, you know, you should be horrified if, like, you know, when you're when you have an ant invasion in your kitchen and you're trying to use your dustpan and your broom to sweep them harmlessly into the dustpan and then bonk them outside in the garden so none of them get hurt. I do that. That a few of them die, which they do. It's not that you're like, oh God, I did this terrible thing. It's more like the fact that you even thought about it is success. It means that your heart is oriented toward non-harming. And the orientation of the heart toward non-harming is the whole thing. So the thing that is great about, like, we use Abby's Netflix account, the thing that's great about it is that when I use it, if I choose to do so, I pause for a moment and I say, you know, is this the right thing to do? And sometimes I'm like, we're family, it's totally the right thing to do, it's fine, you know. And in other situations, right, I think about this every year with taxes, where it's like the whole game of taxes is get as many deductions as you can, you know? And the accountant people, they're like, do you have anything else you can add in here? Did you drive somewhere? That I'm like, I'm not really using the car for business. And they're like, yeah, but did you, like, did you have a conversation about business while you were in the car doing something? You know? And it's like, did you go out to dinner with your family, but you talked about work a little bit? Deduct it, right? And I'm like, eh. And the beautiful thing about the precepts is just that you have that moment. That's the thing that's important, is that you stop and you go, oh, is this going to weigh on my heart? So it becomes an enjoyment for the mind, because when you practice like that for a while, you're in situations where you know you haven't caused harm and you're not gonna, and that's so pleasurable. It's so nice. It's such a relief to be free of the temptation to do things that cause harm. It's so sweet. So that's an enjoyment from the mind. And then here's the liberating piece. It's the ford where all the Buddhas cross over. And I love that line. So I labeled the post with that quote. The ford where all the Buddhas cross over. The Buddha in another place, someone asked him, how did you cross the flood? So the flood of samsara, the flood of sensual desire and grasping and fear and the whole difficult emotional relational realm. How did you get through that to the other shore of being fully released? And the Buddha says, by neither stopping nor straining, I crossed the flood. He said, if I stopped, I was swept away. And if I strained, I was swept away. But slow and steady, neither stopping nor straining, did I cross the flood. And so here it says ethics, ethical conduct, is the ford where the Buddhas cross over. So adding those two kind of similes together, you get, like, yes, stopping and not straining, but also don't try to cross the river at its deepest, most dangerous spot. That's basically tantric practice. We'll get onto that later, right? You know, but really, you know, it's like make it as easy for yourself as possible. And the best you can make it for yourself is if you tend your actions. So I'll finish up here in time for a couple questions. Ethics are the matchless power. Ethics are the ultimate weapon. Ethics are the best ornament. Ethics are a marvelous coat of armor, back to the kind of protective field. Ethics are a mighty bridge, the unsurpassed scent, the best perfume that float from place to place. There's a verse elsewhere there's a verse in the Dhammapada that says, the fragrance of flowers goes with the wind, but the fragrance of virtue pervades everywhere, going even against the wind. So virtue as a kind of fragrance that radiates from good people. Ethics are the best provision, the unsurpassed supply for a journey. Ethics are the best vehicle that take you from place to place. And then here's a couple that are apparent in our public sphere. In this life, they're criticized. After departing, they grieve in a lower realm. A fool is unhappy everywhere because they are unsteady in ethics. But in this life, they're renowned. After departing, they're happy in heaven. The wise one is happy everywhere because they are steady in ethics. And then the last verse turns toward liberation again. Ethical conduct is best in this life, but one with wisdom is supreme, or one who conjoins ethics with wisdom, right? Sila with punya is supreme. Someone with both virtue and wisdom is victorious among humans and gods. So as we continue, we'll talk about some of the aspects of practice that are this ethical conduct field, and in a sense keep coming back to how it's the foundation of the path and how the other limbs of the path in a sense weave through ethical conduct. Good. So a closing reflection. I'll last just a few moments, but anything bubbling from just that before we end? Yes, sir.
I sort of had an aunt story just yesterday, literally, and it was just kind of nice to hear you make that distinction about not freaking out about having to, a few of them die, or even I found myself in conversation sometimes too, walking away from something and saying, did I say exactly what I wanted to say, or was I as accurate in my statement as I should have been or could have been?
Yeah.
I get all in my head and I'm like,
totally.
I meant to say that, and I feel all this regret and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So it's just nice actually kind of lightening my heart a little bit to kind of hear that it's okay,
It's not be totally, it's okay.
All the details and stuff.
Yeah. The mind that obsesses about it is the hindrance of doubt. Right, so that's less necessary. But the mind that in a certain way, again, the thing that's important here is that you care, that you want to do well, and that in a way the mind is going, was that good? Was that clear? How could that be clearer? And in a way, the practice is not like, how can I consume myself with regret and like, oh, I did it wrong, whatever. But more like, oh, I noticed that didn't land the way I wanted it to, or that could have been clearer or kinder, or I slipped up, or I made a mistake, or I really caused harm, whatever it is. And then, the path is both like completely unforgiving in a certain way. Like, it's like, yes, you did that, now you have, and completely forgiving. It's like, yes, you did that, and in this next moment, everything is exactly the same. It's still like, okay, well, given present conditions, what can I do that causes less harm? Like, and it just goes, it's like the loop is small, and ultimately the loop is like moment to moment to moment. So I say something and I'm like, oh, that didn't land quite right, or my intention wasn't quite clear. I have the opportunity in the next moment to maybe say, hey, that didn't come out quite right. Can I try that again? And like moment to moment, there's this like, if I can stay out of the like beating myself up thing, which really just increases isolation. That's a way of saying like, oh, I made a mistake with you, so I'm going to recede further. Right? I have that habit, but the training is like, try not to do that. Come back forward and say, oh, that was a mistake. or you know, something just happened. Now let's go from here. You know, what can we do here? And so, as much education and training as I can do internally, it's still going to be the case that this whole realm that we're entering is relationship. You know, it's all relational. And so moment to moment to moment, letting go of blame, but sustaining responsibility and the ability to respond. You know, with the ants mostly, I just talk with them. I'm like, come on guys, come on. Sorry, don't go in circles. Come on back over here. Come on. I'm so sorry you died. You may be well. Come on, everybody outside. Everybody's, you know, it's like, and somehow it feels, you know, a little better.
Thank you.
For sure. All right. So next week we'll either continue fleshing this out, or we'll go right into this first limb of wise speech. So thanks for being here. Lovely to have everybody. Happy to be back. And see you soon. Take good care.